Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, and welcome to the EAN Cast, the weekly podcast of the European Academy of Neurology. I am Maria Chiara Malaguti, Head of Neurology Department in Rovereto in the north of Italy, and co-chair with Dr. Alicia Corroni of the EAN Task Force on Artificial Intelligence in Clinical Neurology. Artificial intelligence is moving very quickly into clinical medicine, including neurology, and that immediately raises some important questions, especially if we think at its adoption in daily practice. How reliable is it? Can we trust the systems that are often difficult to interpret? How do we use AI in a way that supports clinical care without weakening human responsibility? To address the many challenges that the use of AI raises, EAN has created a dedicated task force. It is a multidisciplinary task force involving neurologists, computer scientists, and experts in ethics and regulatory aspects. This podcast is one of our educational initiatives, and it is the 200th episode of podcast series. Today, we are discussing a very provocative topic, AI versus human intelligence, the contest. To explore all this, I'm very pleased to welcome Gary Leeming. Gary, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, everybody.
Gary is the director of the Civic Health Innovation Labs based at the University of Liverpool. Formerly, he was the chief technology officer at the Connected Health Cities program, developing technology and infrastructure for learning health system, as well as investigating distributed ledger technologies for management of health data. He's an expert in digital innovation and health information exchanges, and is actually working on many projects. So, Gary, this is clearly the right moment to have this conversation because AI is already influencing research, education, and increasingly clinical practice as well. And in neurology, that opens a lot of opportunities, but also a lot of uncertainty. When we talk about human versus artificial intelligence in neurology, what are we really comparing? Are we comparing speed, consistency, accuracy, or something broader? It is preferable probably not to compare human versus artificial. What do you think about?
I think that artificial intelligence is... Yeah, there's been a lot of debate about the name artificial intelligence, right? I mean, it's from a technical perspective, we understand it. It's kind of it is a computer or a machine that does a task that appears intelligent, appears as though it was done with human-like intelligence. But it is artificial. There is not actual intelligence sort of sat behind it in the way that we would understand it in a human being. And I think, though, the term artificial intelligence conjures up images of robots and Star Trek computers and things that mean that we sort of kind of impute a consciousness to it that isn't there. But if we stick with the technical definition of it is a set of tools that help us to sort of reason, that help us to understand something that's in front of us, whether that's interpreting an image or collecting together information from a mass of clinical records or diagnoses or test results, and then presenting an output from that that we can then use to make a decision, a clinical decision about a patient, then it can help us across those areas that you were talking about. It can help us to be faster. It can help us to be more accurate within that speed as well. And it can help us to really also drive forwards our capabilities in terms of being able to be better at delivering care through all of those areas, really. So it's going to be incredibly important, I think, in how we can integrate this new sets of tools into clinical practice, but just to be cautious about what it actually means. I think in terms of actual practice and how we do come to rely on it is definitely one of the big unsolved questions.
Yeah, you're totally right. And that's a very helpful place to start because in medicine, the word better can mean many different things. a system can be faster, but does not automatically make it wiser in clinical practice. So this is an important distinction to have in mind. And I would like now to go a little bit deeper. One of the most common claims about AI is that it can detect patterns on a scale no human can match. AI can manage a huge amount of data. How important is the quantity, but also the quality of data and their distribution and the harmonization of data collection in AI use?
I think that quantity of data often depends on the particular type of AI or machine learning that you're talking about. You know, you can still achieve some great results with minimal amounts of information, but quality is absolutely a key factor in how we make AI useful. If we have unreliable data, if that data has gaps or biases within it, the AI can't help us to necessarily explain those or understand those, because it can only use what it knows, what it has. It can't kind of generate new knowledge in that way. I think that's one of the key issues. So, you know, the bias in data, for example, can be manifested in ways that are unexpected, but it can also be just, we need to think about what is the nature or type of data that we have. An obvious example, you know, from the last few years has been systems that analyze you know, images of skin for tumors and the like. You know, those algorithms were trained on paler skin and did not work for darker skin, so they were missing diagnoses that would have been obvious to a human being that could have translated that. And I think it's important to recognize, therefore, that when we're developing this, what has been the source of those data, how are we curating those data, and how are we investing in making sure that we address those types of challenges. With large language models, for example, you know, they're being trained on, you know, a corpus of language, particularly from the internet. But how does that translate to people with, you know, if we're talking about English language systems, people with poor English, people who maybe use different idioms in their language? How are we training it for different types of languages and making sure that we have the validation of it? So there's a whole set of questions there, I think, around, absolutely, around how do we make sure the data are appropriate and work for that.
Yes, and this point is extremely important because it raises the problem of the issue of generalizability and reliability of a system. So how can a neurologist can know when an AI system is reliable or not? The system is performing well in some areas of healthcare, but what should be the tips we have to have in mind to be cautious and not to trust blindly an AI tool?
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to, as well, how have we purchased the system? How have we tested the system? How is it sort of implemented? How is it integrated into the sort of clinician's workflow, basically? There's a whole set of challenges around just things like, you know, how do we do that? And I think it's recognizing with some of these tools, we need that learning health system approach. We need that complete sort of integration of complete, you know, sort of testing and validating our outputs and our work constantly in order to be able to sort of really gain that trust in these two new tools. But in gaining that trust as well, we need to recognize that there are biases in human behavior, things like automation bias, where especially for younger clinicians who don't have the experience or expertise of people who've been working for years, they would maybe take an output from a machine learning algorithm and trust it more, or not trust themselves more in the face of what appears to be an expert system. And there may be sort of mistakes carried through from that. So we have to find ways to, as I said, both develop that sort of learning health system approach, so to kind of integrate that constant sort of validation testing, but also train our clinicians to sort of question and sort of understand how to use the outputs from these tools more effectively.
That point is really critical, because sometimes a model can look really strong and very impressive from a technical point of view, but then it can perform much less well when we move into clinical practice, as the skin imaging you were telling before. So, and once we talk about trust, we inevitably come to the black box problem. A major concern is this black box issue, because if an AI system produces a recommendation, but the clinician cannot really understand how it got there, this creates a contrast, a tension. Can we realistically make this system interpretable enough for clinical use? Because clinicians want to know why the system makes a decision, why it gives us a suggestion, and what is the level of transparency that is needed to trust.
I think that some AI systems are more transparent than others, but there's no doubt that, especially with the newer, more complex deep learning models and large language models, that we're seeing systems that become very difficult to explain how they did get to the answer that they get to. However, we're also seeing systems that you can ask them, how did you come up with that? And they can start to explain it to you. They can look at the sources. And there is, I think, definitely a need to really look at how we expect these systems to really break down those decision points that they got to. Some of that black boxness is intentional, I think, in terms of, you know, a company has a IP wrapped up into their algorithm that they want to protect, and so there are decisions that they, you know, they're sort of making to sort of hide that. Others are kind of being much more transparent about how those systems can work. But it's definitely the case that this is going to become a bigger problem over time, with particularly when you look at things like the new agentic pipelines, or, you know, sort of frameworks where you have lots of AI working together. It kind of becomes even harder to explain which one made the decision at any particular point in time. And so, you know, this is an active area of research. It's something that we need to kind of do recognize, and we do need to sort of resolve. But at the same time, I think some of this also is, you need to just kind of recognize that it's, if the output is correct and it's always correct, do we need to know? What's the level of trust that we can actually put into this decision-making, even as clinicians? How can we sort of feel confident that it is working? And that kind of comes back again to that sort of idea of, you know, sort of validating the output, of kind of it showing that it can be trusted because it's working. You know, we don't necessarily understand how a drug works in terms of the mechanism of it, or we may uncover a side effect of a drug that actually is a positive impact on another condition. So there are different ways of looking at this as a problem that I think we kind of need to investigate and understand where are those guidelines or that we can construct to make this safe to use and trustworthy enough through the demonstration of it, without us having to understand exactly how it always gets to those answers. However, we do have this problem of hallucination, right? We are, especially with the large language models, and where things are getting wrong, we do have, as I mentioned, the problems of automation bias. We've got these sort of questions of, are our clinicians being trained to use these algorithms and to question them appropriately? I'm not sure that younger clinicians would necessarily have that same level of skepticism to an algorithm that maybe they ought to have. So this is maybe also something that we do have to start thinking about how we teach it.
Okay, thank you, Gary. Actually, I can tell you that the clinician want to understand the clinical reasoning. The problem is not only the right answer to a problem, to a clinical problem, but to understand the pathway to arrive to a solution for patients. So we would like to know why an LLM system generates an answer in that way or another, and what is the extent of reliability. Because this problem brings another question about responsibility. If AI contributes to treatment decision, for example, who is responsible in the end when something goes wrong? The clinician, the institution, the developer of the AI system. I'm not sure that our current clinical culture is ready for a sort of shared responsibility between AI and humans. And in practice, does responsibility still remain entirely to the physician or not?
I think I completely agree with you in terms of can we even split that accountability? Can we even split that? Ultimately, it's always the clinician that has to be able to, justify it. Putting it crudely, looking at how this has worked in things like self-driving cars and the ethicists that are working on sort of questions around even just something like that. As a question as to who is responsible should a self-driving car get into an accident. This is that problem absolutely multiplied, and we can't answer any of those questions right now. I guess, yes, as I said, putting it crudely, it's kind of who gets sued, right? I mean, who ultimately is going to be held legally accountable for all of this? If we're going to expect clinicians to use this, I think we do need to think about what levels of protections we can put in for clinicians using these systems. But also, again, it comes down to a clinician is always going to feel more comfortable making a decision that they feel that they understand. Absolutely. And how do we design those systems so that they are explainable is definitely a focus for where we need to go. And I think with a large language model, you can ask it to explain, but can you trust its explanation? I mean, there's a whole level of, is it reasonable for it to sort of say, oh, I did that. I don't know if you've seen, there was a article a while ago about, I think it was a writer talking to an AI, and the AI was just would say something, and the writer would say, but that's not true. And the AI would apologize and say, yes, you caught me, I lied, but here's another answer. But that one would also be false. And there's a whole sort of set of conversations. Now, what has happened since then is that the AIs have been improved, and that as a problem has been recognized and worked on, and so that they're becoming more, it's becoming easier to ask them to explain their reasoning and to trust them. But what is the point at which we can actually trust them? How does that define is one of the big questions. And as I mentioned with the self-driving cars, there's a lot of work on with our ethics colleagues to really kind of start to unpick and tease that apart. And the self-driving cars example is an interesting one because do you know when the first self-driving car drove from across America from one coast to the other?
No, I didn't.
1995.
Oh.
Right. But we still don't have self-driving cars everywhere. Now, some of that is technology. It was fairly primitive, fairly basic. But some of that is those questions of who is responsible if you have a robot taxi? Who is responsible if that taxi is ordered by the by the passenger to stop somewhere illegally and gets out, and the passenger is injured by another car? Who is responsible if the instruction is to protect the passenger and the brakes fail and it drives into somebody crossing a road? Those are the same questions that I think we do have to answer, but we don't have simple answers to. And we have to find a way to turn that into law as well, which is another layer on top of that. And we don't have any of that in place. So how do we... That's a years-long thing. And in the meantime, we've got this push to say AI everywhere, let's generate, millions of pounds worth of billions of pounds worth of dollars or euros worth of investments in health AI. But we haven't solved the problem of what happens when things go wrong, because that doesn't generate nature papers and it doesn't generate the input from venture capitalists, that's needed. But it is needed if we're going to make a change. So there is this tension between the two. I just don't know if it's anything other than that slow, incremental development and integration of these tools. And to be fair, going all the way back to the invention of the stethoscope, you know, doctors rejected the stethoscope at first because they didn't understand it, right? Now, this is way more complicated, obviously, and it's understandable why you'd be nervous about it. But I think we can get to the point where we feel comfortable, where we have that evidence base. And it's about recognizing that it is about that building that evidence base. It's about building that learning health system approach to sort of saying, we need to capture the data, we need to test it, we need to validate it, we need to sort of recognize how it's being used. And through that, that approach is not to say just trust the AI. That approach is to say, let's use the human expertise that we have to really understand what is it that we think it's doing, as well as try and deal with it from a technical perspective of making it better at explaining itself. So that's, sorry.
I totally agree with you. And I think that your example and your comparison between healthcare and automatic driving is really strong and clear to understand for our listeners today. And I believe that probably this suggestion, if you agree, is that we have to find a right working distance between AI and humans. AI can support decision making, yes, but does not replace completely professional accountability. And I would like to mention you a recent paper. I don't know if you know it. It's about a paper which compares the humans and the AI to Schopenhauer's hedgehog dilemma. This dilemma describes a group of hedgehogs on a cold day. They move close to share warmth, but their spines hurt each other, so they go away. If they stay too far apart, they freeze, but if they get too close, they get wounded. And over time, they learn a workable distance, close enough to benefit, far enough to avoid harm. And I think this is a good metaphor for the relationship between humans and artificial intelligence, because we do like speed, efficiency, and support in our daily work. But the closer we get, the more we risk being pricked by hidden bias, the skilling, dependency, manipulation. So we really need a calibrated closeness to get the benefit.
Yeah.
What do you think is the right distance?
I think that's a great analogy, actually. That's pretty good. I'll have to look that paper up. I think, in terms of what is the right distance, I think just before I answer that, I think there's another problem, which is that, you know, from the companies that are developing these algorithms perspective, particularly in wider society, it sometimes feels like they are trying to push us together, right? Because the closer we get in that way, the more sort of investment and money and things that are generated from this. So there is already a tension in how those hedgehogs are kind of trying to find that right distance, because we're trying to be pushed together. But in terms of what is the right distance, it's a really hard one to answer, to be frank. I just don't think we really know right now. I think we have to have the right distance is where the human still feels accountable. This human still feels like they have made the decision that they understand for themselves, and they made the right decision in that way. I think that's probably the closest I could get to an answer right now, because it is difficult. I think clearly there has to be a use of AI in healthcare. Yeah, we're well past the stage of kind of saying this doesn't help. But how do we define that line? How do we define that line that kind of says suddenly we've become not accountable? I don't know. An interesting area or space within that as well, I think, is going to be around what about patients themselves? How are they using AIs in their lives to manage their conditions? And how are they responding to those decisions or suggestions from AI that they're not talking to their doctors or clinicians about? So I think how have you seen sort of patients using tools as a clinician how we sort of see that sort of changing? I know that we have in the UK, we've had GPs, general practitioners, family doctors, sort of saying that, you know, they have patients coming to them that are perfectly healthy, but their Apple Watch has kind of said that they may have something with their heart that they need to go and get checked out. And actually, there's nothing wrong. So it's kind of generating anxiety as well in that space. But I think this sort of the patient side is probably another area that we need to sort of understand more about.
I think this you are touching a very two very important points. One is that the clinicians still feel accountable when using AI, and this is extremely important because it is the basis of our accountability is the basis of our work and our job. And the other problem is that our patients coming to clinicians with a diagnosis made by ChatGPT or other LLMs. And so it is very difficult to confute this diagnosis sometimes or to explain to a patient that we have in mind another workflow, diagnostic workflow, another management, because they are still inside this conviction that ChatGPT is better than humans, than clinicians. So really, this is an important topic. And this brings me to another point, because how can we be able to tackle with this problem of education, for example, with AI? We need to know AI, and probably our learning curve across years is going to be reshaped by AI in the next year. Do you think that it will change the way we train residents and young neurologists with AI methods?
So I think it's probably already happening, because I suspect the students are already doing it for themselves. And I think that this is a conversation that we've had in our institute, in our medical school, is how do we teach even just sort of basic skills around data and statistics to our clinicians to make sure that they have that grounding to make the decisions about how they understand and interpret. Some of this is, you know, we see this as well in, you know, teaching code. You know, with the large language models like Claude and Copilot can generate computer code that our students are just kind of using and generating, and they can generate masses of this. But the question is, do they understand it? Do they understand those things? So I think there's kind of two parts to that question, one of which is this: the first part is, are we teaching how to use those tools appropriately, and how are we developing those materials? And the second part is, with those tools there, how are we making sure that people still have enough fundamental understanding to be able to use those tools correctly and afterwards as well? You know, otherwise we'll end up with, you know, clinicians who can apparently make the right decisions about a patient, but maybe don't actually themselves fully understand it. And how do we get there? Now, I don't believe that our current education systems would allow somebody who is effectively at that level to get through, because we have very rigorous sort of processes for testing and checking and training and all the rest of it. But I think it is going to be an issue of how do we sort of make sure, though, that we're finding that right balance in the education sort of part of it. So some of it's probably going to be recognizing where it works and finding out where it doesn't work from a healthcare perspective, and then bringing that in.
Yeah. Do you think that at this point, that is important that neurologists have some mathematical expertise, computer science expertise on this point or not?
I think, yeah, it's interesting. I was talking about this yesterday with somebody, and a lot of people are coming out of clinical backgrounds and other scientific backgrounds, and they're kind of learning to code, right? They're teaching themselves how to use Python and R because they find it useful to do so. But often these are people that don't want to learn maths. They don't want to learn, you know, some of the complexities of it. But the thing about coding is that it's effectively a way of setting out logically something that you want to achieve. So I think there is probably something around how we do teach some basic coding skills, how we do look at some of the challenges around data that should be included in that, because it's going to become increasingly important If we're expecting somebody, as we said, to be accountable for a decision that they've made on the back of an algorithm, they should understand what an algorithm is if they're going to be able to feel confident in doing that. So maybe that's one of the things that helps us to bring the hedgehogs closer together.
Okay, Gary, thank you. Let me close with one final practical question. If you had to leave a neurologist listening today with one practical message, what would it be? Do you suggest to ask to two different or three different LLMs when asking for a clinical question? How to use OpenAI in a way that is open-minded but still responsible? Just practical issue.
I think, to be honest, the most practical thing I would say is find your sort of colleague, your machine learning colleague who can help you. That's probably the best thing to do. If you're wanting to sort of understand and move into this space, go and talk to the computer scientists, go and talk to the engineers in your area, because we need to take a far greater multidisciplinary approach to this going forwards. And they're the ones that can help you to understand those skills. So I think more than anything else, I think I would suggest actually look at who you have around you that can actually help you to understand it more, because rather than sort of turning to a large language model or to just certainly not the materials that come from the salespeople that visit our hospitals, it's probably reach out to your university and kind of work with them to understand, you know, can we construct these multidisciplinary teams. That's been very much the approach that we've taken at CHILL, where we have this sort of design studio approach. We've kind of said, you know, we want to bring people together around a problem to solve the problem, not to think about the technology.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. We have to team up with computer scientists in the next years. It's absolutely the central point, because it is the human-human interaction in that way. Okay, it's a human-human. So I think, thank you so much, Gary. This has been a very clear and very useful discussion. And in the end, the future is probably not human versus artificial, but human with human, computer scientists and clinician together. And the future is one in which human clinician work with AI decision support tools, only support, finding this right distance we were talking about before. So thank you very much, Gary, for joining us today. And thank you to all our listeners for joining us for this episode of the EAN Cast Weekly Neurology.
Thank you.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.